Boys and girls, ladies and gents, welcome to another episode of Clutch Conversations. It's your boy Mike. We back at you one more game live on a Thursday night. It's going down tonight. We got the homie DJ from Reptiles for Centuries in the building. We're going to get to the show here in just a few minutes. But first and foremost, shout out to my lovely wife, Takara. Appreciate everything you do. Appreciate you holding down. She's a little bit under the weather, so y'all make sure y'all show us some extra love tonight in the comments. And don't stop there. Make sure to show the channel some love as well. Hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, and Hulk smash that notification bell so you can get notifications each and every time we drop a video here on the channel. And don't forget, Clutch Conversations is available on all major podcasting platforms. That's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. So when you're checking us out there on your favorite podcasting platform, please be sure to follow, rate, and review. It really helps us out. We appreciate the love, and we definitely appreciate the support. Speaking of support, if you're out here supporting, if you're out here in this reptile hobby in any shape, form, or fashion, make sure you're supporting USART and USART Florida. The link for both organizations are in the description of the video. Definitely go get your membership. Drop a donation when you can, when you're sending your snakes out. Make sure you round up to the nearest dollar. Do all that. Make sure you spread the word about both these organizations that's helping protect our rights as reptile keepers. Speaking of spread the word, make sure you spread the word about our dope sponsors as well. We're going to get this first sponsor video, then we're going to say what's up to some folks in the chat.
Big dreams start in small towns. Small Town Exotics is a family-ran business that specializes in high-quality ball python morphs, western hog noses, and select leopard geckos. They are proud members of USART, USART Florida, and the Orient Society. Stay connected with Small Town Exotics on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. Witness their journey as they grow their business and showcase their animals to the world. Thank you, Small Town Exotics, for sponsoring the show.
Art comes in many forms. At Armless Angels, it comes to life.
Shout out to the sponsors, man. Appreciate you, Shane. Appreciate you, Justin, man. Really appreciate all the support. Let's see who we got in the chat tonight. Got the homie Sammy in the building. What's good, brother? Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. Vinny from Bone Daddy Serpents. What's good, brother? Appreciate you coming out. Rock, what's good, bro? Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. Tom, what's up? Low Life Exotics in the building. What's good? Got the homie Malaysio, Wiz Constrictors in the building. Again, shout out to the Wiz Tang fam. Appreciate you coming out, folk. Big Tank Hank in the building. What's good, brother? Good to see you. The homie Bosa, the Sultan of Support himself. Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. What's good? Moon over Miami. What's good, homie? Appreciate you coming out. Got one of the sponsors in the building. What's good, Matt? Appreciate you coming out, brother. Ray and Charles, what's good? If it's your first time coming through, definitely hit that subscribe button and Hulk smash that notification bell. Scaled Worm in the building. What's good? Appreciate you coming out. Got the homie Eric's More Factory in the building. What's good, brother? Appreciate you coming out, fam. The homie Logan, what's good? Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. Big Ed in the building. What's good, homie? Appreciate you coming out. Got Dale from Constricted Reptiles. What's good? Florida in the building. Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. We got the homie Keys, an ex-Florida alum in Georgia. Now, what's good? We're going to stop it right there on the homie. Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate the support. We're going to kick the intro, then we'll be right back to the show.
baby, won't you listen to me? I got that flavor, I know you're dying to feed. I ain't no dancer, just got some hip in my feet. Now throw your hands up. Ooh, you bring the lighter, I got the fuse. You make a fire, I'll add the fuel. Follow my lead, just watch your shoes.
Episode 108, Reptiles for Centuries. What's good, bro? How you doing?
Good and you, Mike.
Just good, about good, early, man. But we say again?
No, just a bit early in the morning, but we're all good, man.
Yeah, man, I appreciate you making some time in your schedule to join us at 3 a.m. your time, man. Round of applause for this, man.
No stress, man. I'm honored to be on your show. I just checked the intro. You had some amazing guests on already. I mean, it's a huge honor to join your show as well, man.
I appreciate that, bro. I really appreciate it, man. It's good to have you, man. Really looking forward to catching up with you, chatting, and talking some snakes, man. It should be fun.
For sure, man. Looking forward to it, eh? Looking forward to it.
Yeah, man. So how's your day been going, or how was your day going? Obviously, it's like middle of the night for you right now, but what was on the reptile agenda for today?
Yeah, so yesterday we took some pictures of all of the new. So our seasons is totally opposite to you guys' seasons, you know. So when you start to pair, we only start to hatch out animals again, and, you know, vice versa. So, yeah, we set up some of the hatchlings earlier this week, and then we took some pictures of, you know, all of the hatchlings that hatched out, and got just busy editing some of the pictures, going through all of them and making sure which ones is the, you know, the adequate ones in terms of quality and stuff like that. And then I just had a couple of guys over to come look at some snakes, and further just a good day at the snakes, man.
Nice. Yeah, I definitely want to get into like your overall process and how the season's going and stuff like that. But before we get too far into all of that, so give us kind of the rundown for those that don't know about like how you got into breeding and kind of like your start in the reptile industry.
Yeah, so I turned 22 actually in January. So I've been keeping reptiles, you know, for majority of my lifespan or my my life. I've had my first bearded dragon I got when I was at the age of 5 years, and then the following year I got a pair of corn snakes. Then I stumbled into, you know, some of the, how can you say, python species and stuff. Over the next couple of years I had, you know, berms, boas, you name it, you know, I had everything almost, you know, until like I'd say 2012, and that's where I really started to you know, go into the ball pythons. I did have ball pythons prior to that, but I only had a, you know, a pair of normals. And then, yeah, from 2012 I really started to like dive into the morphs. Early on I had a couple of family members also, you know, investing with the snakes or investing into the snakes. And then later on, I'd say from 2018, you know, we've actually been a sole company. We've been running it by myself. So far so good, man. We're only starting to get into the projects that I really think is, you know, going to outlay the paths in the near future. So every year it just gets more exciting, you know, and I think honestly the best is yet to still come, you know, from everyone in this industry. So I'm really excited to see where we can take it, eh?
Yeah, facts, man. Like, it's crazy, like, how many different genetics, how many different combos, and just, like, we haven't even really, like, hit the tip of the iceberg, right? It's just the tip of the iceberg for a lot of this stuff. It's so many things to be done with a lot of these projects. Like, I talk a lot of time with like some of my friends about like the double recesses and the triple recesses, and how really there's really only been like a, considering like how many possibilities that are out there, there's really only been like a small amount of things made, or at least things that's made and for sale and stuff like that. So it's just, it's so much further to go with it. So what drew you specifically to the ball pythons? When you start getting the ball pythons, were you thinking in terms of breeding, or at the beginning, was it just kind of like keeping for you?
Yeah, so, you know, like I think with everyone, if you start out, you know, you buy too many males and stuff like that, bro, you know. So at the time, I think I had like maybe 20 odd males and a couple of normal females, you know. I decided, you know, like, flip, you know, if I really want to dive into it, you know, I need to be more selective, you know. And actually, back when we started, you know, when I started, you know, you couldn't even get a normal female, you know. They were like literally like gold back then, you know. I remember, you know, literally going past like pet shops and stuff like that just to collect the normals, you know, just to get some normal females and stuff. But the snake had really drew my attention towards breeding, specifically, you know, the ball pythons were the pites. You know, I remember still, you know, one evening I was scrolling through someone's website, a local breeder's website, and I saw the pied ball python. That's really where my, my fascination for this, the genetics of the animals really started to evolve, you know, and really to see, you know, the true potential of the ball python genetics. So I'd say, you know, just, I think I was just mind blown, you know, by the pied, to see an animal like that. You know, I think, you know, the general public and, you know, even myself back then, you know, I was used to the albinos and maybe the odd white snake, but, you know, a pied is completely different. So I'd really say, you know, the pieds is really where, you know, my true passion started for the genetics. And still to the date, you know, my favorite animal is just a plain pied, just because they're so unique.
Nice, nice. So kind of thinking about your initial mindset when you really start taking the breeding piece of it seriously, how has kind of your mindset evolved since then as it relates to like how you do your business, how you're thinking through your projects? Like, talk about the evolution over time.
So yeah, I'd say in the start, you know, when I started off, it was all of the projects that I was doing were you know, more co-dominant mutations. You know, I was in the first couple of years, I was, you know, heavily invested, you know, into banana and stuff like that. You know, I invested early on in banana. And then now as my, how can you say, my vision has changed, I try and, you know, I've based my collection around like three main recessives, which is desert ghost, clown, and pied. And then I try and incorporate, you know, whether it's being other recessives or other co-dominant mutations into those three main recessives. And, you know, over the years, you know, what I've seen is it's important for myself and, you know, for my collection going forward, you know, to breed with animals which will have a long-term value in my collection. You know, I like to keep animals back, which is especially females. If I keep back females, I like to keep back females where I can pair with them at least three or four seasons, you know. So, and what I've also seen is to keep back animals as far as possible to avoid, you know, making difficult ID situations, you know. In the start, you know, I used to just pair, not just pair animals together, but I wasn't so selective necessarily with the amount of genes in the combos. But now I'd really try and, you know, pin it down to make the IDs also a bit easier. You know, in some cases, it's a bit harder, but as far as possible, I try and, you know, avoid pairings which will, you know, cause some confusion and stuff like that. So I think how my mindset has changed over the years, I think it's just going into certain projects where I didn't necessarily like go into, you know, just because I actually see the true potential of the projects now. And yeah, just slowly starting to build the collection to the point where, like I said, you know, I want to produce animals which, if you work with them, there's no complications in terms of IDing the stuff. You know, I want to, as far as possible, produce visual stunning animals and make it as far as possible to take it to the next generation, you know. So to try and avoid those white snakes and try and, you know, get as far as possible to, you know, to the best you know, at a bull python. I think that's where we're all working towards, you know, keeping animals, which is, we look as amazing as hatchlings and as adults, you know, trying to keep that contrast in the future.
Gotcha. So speaking of pie is one of my favorite morphs as well. Like, it was one of the first ones that kind of caught my eye early on. And I know, like, for a lot of people, when they don't know anything about ball pythons, and even for some people who don't even like snakes, when they see a pied, like, they're just like, wow, because it just looks so crazy, especially like when you're first getting in. So sometimes people talk about like reaching peak pied and there's not a lot more to do with pied. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think so with pieds, I think as well, you know, I think, like we said, with everything, we're still scratching the surface. I think there is some morphs which unfortunately takes away a bit from pied, you know, so I'd always say try and incorporate, you know, the best of both. You know, some of the genes, if you add them into, for instance, like fire and yellow belly, those genes normally in pieds, they make them a bit higher white, but if you incorporate orange stream, enchi, all of these things, it brings back a lot of patterning. So I would say is, if you work with pies, just try and, you know, get a perfect in between, you know, try and get your codom gene stacks in, which will bring back the patterning, and then play with something that will increase the coloration. So I wouldn't say we've reached like the potential of pies. I think, you know, there's a lot of potential still with the gene itself. And I think if you incorporate the right genetics with it, you know, we're still going to see a lot of awesome combos being produced in the pied project. One of the projects I'm very excited to see is, for instance, the confusion pied stuff. I really think those will make a huge difference as well, you know, incorporating those into the clown pied project and, you know, going even further with that.
Has anyone hit a confusion clown pied yet, to your knowledge?
No, I've seen a few confusion pieds. I think Justin has produced a few, and I think Marcelo from Exclusive Snakes. So I think they have been produced, but I haven't seen the clown pied version yet. So that will be interesting.
Yeah, I think that'd be nice too. I remember seeing, I think it was, if I got the genes right, I think it was a confusion blackhead pied that was real nice. Like, it was just it was like super dark, and it was a lot of pattern on it too. And so it's like a nice color palette on that. Exactly. I thought it was dope.
That's another gene, you know, especially in the clown pieds, which I think it's going to work well, works very well. I mean, we saw that one from Justin, the blackhead leopard clown pied. I mean, that animal is insane, man. You know, you would have thought actually blackhead would have removed a lot of patterning from the clown pied. It actually did the total opposite. You know, it made it a very low white expression, and it brought it in a lot of contrast as well, which I think is very important, especially with these projects. I think you need to have the perfect mix of both, you know, dark and light genes. I think that's where it's definitely heading into to get, you know, contrast out of the animals. And I think that blackhead does that is extremely well as well.
I want to call out the super chat real quick. Appreciate you both. Appreciate the support, homie. Yeah, I think it's still a good bit to be done with pied and just kind of tinkering with like some genes that maybe haven't been worked in a lot to see like what else can have like a good effect on the pied. But to this day, like, pied is one of my favorite.
Yeah, the thing is, man, you know, that there's with all genes, you know, there's certain genetics that don't work in pied. You know, it's applicable, you know, most of the genes. So I'll just say is, you know, try and, like you said, try and work the X factor, you know, try and do something different. Go for those combinations which hasn't been made before. For instance, I made a spot nose clown pied combo the previous season, you know, and when I made the pairing, I was like, flip, you know, I'm most likely going to end up with a high white snake or complete white snake. And it ended up actually having a lot of pattern distribution, you know, so, and we didn't know that until we actually bred the spot nose clown pieds. You know, prior to that, we saw the spot nose pieds and they were almost like spider pieds, you know. So I think just try and go outside the norm, you know. I really like the lace pied projects as well. I think lace in general is something I'd like to incorporate more into the collection as well, you know, getting back to that producing animals. Where, you know, avoiding the white snakes and stuff like that, I think lace is a great foundation for any project, just because it's such a, you know, a great gene, and it really does increase the coloration. So I think lace, lace part stuff, and also, you know, a very interesting gene, I think, in the parts as well, is sugar or calico.
Okay.
I think you can really disrupt the patterning with sugar and calico as well. And I think if we start seeing, you know, those combos being produced as well, I think it's going to also, you know, make some waves and stuff, eh?
Okay. I don't know if I've seen a sugar or calico pot. Like, how'd you say it reacted with the pot? Like, what does it do?
So it's very, like, almost like yellow, what yellow belly does in pots. It increases the, like, the pixelation and just breaks up the pot settles. But with sugar, it's actually, like, more extreme. You know, you get a real, like, very highly pixelated pot settles. And the nice thing about what I've seen is with sugar, it brings in, like, a different color spectrum. So I hatched out one animal. I'll send you actually after the podcast. It's an OD yellowbelly Enchi sugar pod. And it's actually got the saddles of the pod is like two different colors. So the one saddle's got like a higher orange, and the other one is more of like a slight light gray almost with the orange, you know. So it actually changes the color spectrum completely as well. So and sugar is one of the genes that I actually didn't incorporate, you know, in the collection early on. You know, I actually, when I started off, I had a butter sugar male many years ago, and I never even bred with the male, you know. And then later on, I started to work with an OD yellowbelly sugar female again, and that's how I started to incorporate sugar back into the collection.
Gotcha. Have you ever had any issues like with breeding sugars?
No.
Okay.
No issues. No touch wood. No issues so far, man.
Nice. Yeah, because that's either calico or sugar. The specific animals I was looking at was calico, but I heard somebody say on a podcast one time that they had issues like with getting calicos to breed well, especially with the females. But then I asked around, and everybody who I asked around and talked to had the exact same answer as you. They hadn't had any issues. So that's definitely one I want to get in the collection. I probably won't work with it a ton, but I definitely want to have it float around for some combos, because I mean, it makes some really nice stuff.
Yeah, and I think as well with the sugar is, you know, the nice thing about the sugar is it brings in a lot of coloration as well. You know, even in plain combinations, you know, like the male that I used this past season was a super OD yellowbelly leopard sugar or calico head pied. He's actually a double head clown pied. And I must say, just I think to work with that animal just as a co-dominant gene stack and incorporate that into Ultramore, Monarch, Hypo, and even like Desert Ghost, I think will make a huge difference, because just there's already this added orange from the sugar, and of course then, you know, the other interactions of Orange Dream and Yellowbelly, but the sugar just really amplifies it, you know, and brings out the nice also like nice striping, especially in the leopard combos, you know. So I think in terms of coloration, I think sugar is definitely gonna also play a huge factor, you know, into Ultramore and into these combos as well, eh?
Nice. I guess since we're on the morph talk, we can just continue diving into it now. I know Ultramel is another one that you work with quite a bit, and I also work with Ultramel too. I still think that's a highly untapped project. There's a lot to do with Ultramel still.
I agree, man. I totally agree with you. So Ultramel is one of those, you know, it's something that I'm very fond of. You know, it's a project that I've got also, you know, besides Desert Ghost Clown and Pied, it's also something I've got like quite throughout in the collection, you know. And I must say, I agree with you. I think it's very untapped. I think we've only, you know, started to scratch the surface, especially like with the clown Ultramore combos as well. I think if we start incorporating some darker genes to really also bring it back to contrast, I mean, Ultramore works amazing with black pest or blackhead, all of these type of genes. So I think if we start incorporating that into the Ultramore clown projects, I really think that's going to be an amazing project to be working on. You know, Monarch and Ultramore's it's very like very similar but different. Definitely there's a difference between them. I'll be also diving into Monarch a bit, but the main focus will definitely be Ultramel as well, eh?
Nice. Yeah, 100%. Ultramel is definitely untapped. It's a lot to be done with it. And you're working Ultramel Kiki's, right?
Yeah, so I've got, I bought from, I haven't started, well, I've got a male in the project. So I've got a yellow belly genetic stripe double head Ultramore Clown from Carl Hoffman.
Okay.
And he's going to be my main male for this coming season to try and push that project, the Ultramore Kiki project.
Okay.
So I think, maybe in the next, let's say, 3 to 4 years, maybe we can burn it down and see what. I think, with the genetic stripe clown project in general, I think, we've seen some awesome combos being produced, especially the Desert Ghost clown genetic stripes. Justin has been putting out some real amazing animals from that project. And I think if we try and, do something similar with the Ultramore, but, I really want to get something into the genetic stripe project, which disrupts it even more. Brings up more patterning, and I think there's a couple of genes that will help with that. It's just to really get that gene that will really make that pixelated patterning, because the Kikis are awesome, and I really think if you can even broaden those teardrops and those striping, I think it will be really awesome to get more contrast out of the project as well.
Facts. Yeah, confusion is a gene that works well in that project. I haven't seen a confusion Kiki or confusion Kiki combo, but I did see it was a confusion Krypton Desert Ghost genetic stripe. And the patterning on that one was crazy. I don't know if you saw that one, but Justin posted it a few weeks back. But like the pattern on that was crazy. Like we had been talking, Justin Thomas from Armless Angels. Me and him had been talking back and forth about like the Kiki project because we're both working it and like DJ Kiki stuff like that. And we had been talking about for the longest like how we think confusion is going to look well in that project. And so I definitely think confusion is one of those keys, and then getting some other stuff in there too to kind of like add to that pattern, and it'll be dope.
Yeah, the thing is, man, I think Justin has shown it plenty of times. He's brought some of the stuff that you can't think or react in certain combinations and just brought it to life. So I think, to really push those projects, you need to go to the unknown almost. You need to do something which is out of the ordinary to see if it's going to work. It can be a hit and miss, or it can be a home run. It just depends on how the gene stacks work. And I think confusion, I like confusion. I've really tried to, incorporate it into my clown projects and even to my other projects. And I think in terms of, also working again with a pattern disruption morph, I think confusion works extremely well. And I think later on, if we start seeing, for instance, confusion tri-stripes, I think that's going to be another, major animal. I don't know why, I just think it's going to really break up that tri-stripe patterning, which I think with the tri-stripe, that's another gene. Genetic stripe and tri stripe is very similar. They're both, how can you say, striped animals, mm-hmm. but there's a huge difference, of course. And especially with those two projects, my end goal would be with them is to, as far as possible, disrupt that patterning, to see if we can still get that striped animal, but maybe if we can get some extra teardrops or extra markings coming down the side. And for instance, that's what I think, genetic stripe and tri-stripe, if you incorporate it with like puzzle, for instance, I think that's going to be a real interesting project as well, to see like puzzle genetic stripes, puzzle tri-stripes and stuff like that. I think that's going to be interesting as well.
Are you working tri-stripe as well?
Yeah. I've got, so this past season was the first season where I actually bred some tri-stripe stuff. So I worked with a tri-stripe Head Desert Ghost male that we imported from the UK. And I put him to some Ultramore females. I put him to some DG females. And in the last clutch was the tri-stripe head DG to the hypo spot nose Desert Ghost. So I think we were able to hatch, I think it's 2.3 spot nose DG double head hypo tri-stripes. And I think there were 0.2 triple head tri-stripe hypo DGs, I'm a snake order, man, so probably most of those will just end up in the old back rack in any case, I'm very excited about that project as well, man. I think tri-stripe is also very untapped, very untapped still.
One of my favorite tri-stripe animals that I've seen was that ultra male trash strike. That was nice. Did you see that one?
Yeah, it's insane, man. That thing is insane. I think Justin made us all jealous with that one pairing he posted the other day. I think it was Pestle trash strike DG to the ultra male trash strike. Eh? Amazing pairing. Eh?
Nice, nice. Real quick shout out. Shout out to the sponsor. Appreciate the homie, Justin. Appreciate the super chat. Yeah, Confusion Kiki is the way to go. For sure. For sure. Yeah, man. So what are some other kind of underrated genes that you don't think on a lot of people's radar that maybe they should be paying attention to?
I think vanilla, which is a very simple codon, but it's just getting back to the factor how can you say, like, getting back to the fact of not producing white snakes, you know? I think vanilla, if you have vanilla on both sides, you know, you're not going to end in a, how can you say, direction where you can't go even further. You know, if you have vanilla on both sides, you're just going to end up with a stunning animal, you know? And at the end of the day, it just avoids all of the confusion, you know, in terms of IDing the animals yet again. And I think vanilla plays a huge factor, even in clown combos. I've really liked what vanilla does in general clown combos. I produced the OD Super Vanilla clown, and it's so reduced, man. You know, I think if you add Hypo and Desert Ghost into those projects, it's going to make a huge difference. So I think vanilla is definitely a gene which is, in my opinion, underrated. And I'll definitely say if you can incorporate it in some of your projects, eh?
Yeah, any others?
Yeah, a few of the other ones I really like. I think most people are starting to get into it now is the Xantic projects. I think those are also, it was for many years. I mean, South Africa was probably one of the, in my opinion, for many years, some of the leading, producing some of the leading projects in the Xantics, you know, prior to, you know, a couple of years ago. And I think since the Xantic DigiClown, of course, you know, I think everyone has really started to see the potential of the Xantic. So I think, especially, you know, going forward into some of the projects, I think Xantic is going to make a huge difference in terms of color spectrum as well. Eh?
Gotcha. I feel like one, maybe not so much now, but definitely when I first got in, and we got in like about 4 years ago. About 4 years ago now. But Hypo was one that a lot of people, I feel like, slept on for a while. Because I know there was a lot of people poo-pooing on Hypo when I first got in. But now, like, Hypo's starting to make like a turnaround, and a lot of people working into their projects.
Yeah, I also don't know why Hypo wasn't so, you know, sought after, because it makes actually awesome animals. You know, it cleans up in some combination. It really does clean up, you know, the animal, and it really brings out a lot of. I like the greenish, like blue tint that the Hypo animals brings out in the combinations. You know. I think if you try and like the Mandarin or Hypo stuff is awesome. I really think you can really go far with that direction as well. And Hypo in general, you know, I can't see why it actually wasn't so popular because Hypo works extremely well, very, very well.
Facts. Speaking of Kyle, my favorite animal in my collection is a spot nose Hypo clown female. Like she's.
Yeah,
beautiful and like super clean. Looks better than the day that I got her. Like she just aging well, so I can't wait to get her in the rotation and get some nice animals out of that.
Yeah, I must say the spot, like the Hypo clown project, is something I'm trying to work well with as well. You know, but I'm not just trying to do Hypo clowns by itself. So I'm trying to do like the ultramore Hypo clowns and the Hypo clown parts. That's also one animal that I recently bought in is the Hypo clown part, and you know that male will help me also go into, you know, adding Desert Ghost into that project as well, you know, trying to of course go for the quads and stuff like that. And I mean, even that animal, man, how it changed the clown part, you won't think, you know, just by adding a Hypo it makes such a huge difference. You know, it really does intensify the coloration even the clown parts. So I think with Hypo, like I said, I think a lot of people slept on it and actually worked it out of the collection. But I think, you know, if you work it into the right combinations, you're not gonna go in the wrong direction. I mean, any dark combination works very well with hyper as well. Blackhead, chocolate, even confusion stuff, GHI, all of these things. I think really with the hyper, you can't really go wrong if you work, even the darker stuff, eh?
Yeah, facts. So you brought up Xanthic getting worked a lot in South Africa. Are y'all working I guess let's back up a little bit. So what is the reptile or breeder community look like in South Africa? Like, is it fairly prevalent, about the same, like ratio wise as the States? I know you don't know the exact numbers, but like how jumping is the reptile industry over there?
Yeah, you know what, man, it's nowhere compared to you guys. Just looking at our demographic, we are a much smaller population who actually keeps, reptiles. I think if it's 2%, it's a lot. Unfortunately, I think there's a huge misperception about the snakes. It's just over generations to come, and I think every generation it's getting better and better. At the end of the day, I think people need to understand that the animals actually fear us more than what we fear them, So I think the hobby has definitely grown, I think we're probably, in terms of bull python breeders, I'd say we breed around, almost 5,000 hatchlings roughly a year, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. And, in compared to, to you guys' hobby, we probably a percentage of what you guys are. Honestly, we're really much smaller than what you guys are, but we're starting to really, I think, also represent, and start to produce some awesome animals. We've got, besides that, we've got some really awesome indigenous snakes and reptiles. So I think, over the years to come, I think the hobby is still going to grow. We've got once or twice reptile expos where a large amount of people come through. But yeah, our community, unfortunately, isn't as big as you guys yet. But I think slowly but surely we'll expand more. And, at the end of the day, if we can get to a point where, everyone's got a reptile, I always say if everyone was into the snakes or into ball pythons, there would definitely be an animal for it. The ball pythons are so versatile. So I think it's just to get the people to get comfortable with the animals and work with them. And the only way is to, promote and spread the word of the community, and, building a community around the snakes itself.
Is the community over there like a pretty close-knit community? And you mentioned it was a couple expos and stuff. Are those like big events or whatnot?
Yeah, so the expos has got, I'd say, around 40 exhibitors. Okay. So it's yeah, it's a local casino, it's a venue at the casino. Yeah, so it's, I think, some of the people come through, just to check out the snakes, probably with their families and stuff. So the reptile community is quite strong this side. We try and, I think, as far as possible, help each other out. Because we're a smaller, group of people, it's a lot more intertwined, a lot of people are doing projects with each other, and it's a lot more confined compared to you guys. The only thing is, which is one of my concerns and one of the stuff we need to work on as well, is like a USA ARC, but something for the South African breeders, which I think is going to be a huge factor also in the near coming future, because as the hobby grows, the more eyes are on the hobby itself, so. And unfortunately, as much as we enjoy the animals and working with them, some people are totally against it, And so I think just to have some sort of backing for us as a community, we need to also orchestrate something like that and start building, more of a, I'd say, not a legal position, but just to, in a sense of, if we need to have someone also representing us, that we've got a system in place. So that's something I think we as a community also need to start looking at, because I mean, USA ARC has made a huge contribution to your guys' industry and even to us. I think if it wasn't for USA ARC, we also be in a much worse situation, because The American market or the American situation also dictates what happens into the other countries, you know. So I definitely think we need to also start exploring into that direction.
Has there been any talk that you know of like creating like a organization of that type?
Yeah. So there's definitely in the talks. It's just to get the right system in place, man. You know, get the right people on board and make sure that everyone is committed towards it. You know, at the end of the day, is we're all doing what we love, you know, and we don't also want to lose it for some odd reason, you know. So I think if we can start really working on that a bit more, and I think over the next year, I think most probably we'll get something in place between a couple of our breeders.
Facts, yeah, it's definitely super beneficial, super helpful to have organizations like USARC and USARC Florida, like fighting those battles, like for example, like when the stuff came out with the America Competes Act, and it was like this big, huge packet of like all these pages, and like this was like buried in there, like the average person wouldn't have caught that, but to have somebody combing through that stuff, catching that stuff, bringing it to everybody's attention, getting everybody to take action and reach out to their representatives and stuff like that. Like that's huge. That's helpful. And so you need somebody who is a subject matter expert in that space, who has like York has the community's best interest in mind and can help you fight those battles. So yeah, that's dope that y'all are talking about getting something started like that. In current state right now, like how are the laws over there? Is it like pretty laid back, or do you have to get like permits and stuff like that? Like what all goes into that from like a regulation standpoint?
So it depends on which province you are in. So I'm in Gauteng, which is one of the capitals of South Africa. So for instance, in Gauteng, you don't need to have permits, you know, for the bull pythons and stuff like that. It's just, of course, indigenous species. And, you know, some of the alien invasive species, like, for instance, Burmese pythons has recently been classified as an alien invasive species. So you need to have, for those animals, you need to have, you know, your permits in order. But in terms of, you know, for instance, KwaZulu-Natal, which is another province here in South Africa, they're a bit more laid back in terms of the indigenous species, so you can almost keep anything without a permit there. But in terms of other exotic animals, exotic reptiles, they need to have more permits in order. You know, so I think it just depends on which state or province you're actually going to.
Gotcha. How many provinces are in South Africa?
I think it's 12 or 11.
Okay.
Yeah, 12 or 11. Okay. No, that's actually a good question. I can't think about it on hand now, man. But it's 12 points. Somewhere around there.
Yeah. Roundabouts. So wrapping up on South Africa, are there any breeders that come to mind, like South African breeders that come to mind that you want to shout out?
Yeah, so there's a couple of breeders that's doing some amazing stuff. To name a few, it's Beautiful Snakes, BPM Exotics, which is ball python morphs, which is they've also been like a pioneer of some of the genetics, like Furrow, Striker, Niohala is one of those, the other ones. Another guy who's doing quite well is Ruan Carlitz, which is from Pride's Breeds Passion. He's also, you know, not recently got into the ball pythons, but I'd say for the last 4 years, but I think his vision and the animals he's producing, I think we're going to still see a lot of awesome animals being produced from him, just because he's got a good mindset in terms of his projects and the industry itself, you know. So there's a couple of, in terms of ball python breeders, I'd say those are the guys who's really making a mark. Some of the other breeders which are, you know, doing a different species and stuff is Ultimate Exotics. They're probably the largest reptile breeding facility in South Africa. You know, they work with almost everything, you know, from bearded dragons to ball pythons to whatever. You know, they've got almost everything. And of course, I think, which has also been a good, someone who's been helping the industry a lot here, especially in South Africa, is Dinkelman. I don't know if you've seen him. He's also been on YouTube and stuff.
The names are super familiar.
Yeah, but he's more into like the conservation than necessarily breeding the animals, you know. So which is also good, you know, because he's also got a different outtake, you know, in the industry.
Nice, nice. Hey, I want to take a real quick sponsor break. Then I want to get back and start talking about last season and this season, breeding wise too. But I want to take a real quick sponsor break. We'll be right back in just a second.
No stress, man.
Peace and love, family. We invite you into the heart of our serenity, ancestral royal pythons. At Ancestral Royal Pythons, we're not just breeders, we're nurturers of love and growth. Each of our high-end ball pythons is a tribute to the grandeur of the natural world and our dedication to quality. Reach out today and bring one of our creations into your home. This is Ancestral Royal Pythons. Your journey begins here.
Here's to the exciting world of ebony and ivory reptiles. From unforgettable parties and events to keeping and hatching some of the dopest reptiles in the reptile hobby, we're all about education, quality, integrity, and respect. Hit us up and see how we can help make your next project a reality. Experience Ebony and Ivory Reptiles, where fascination meets fun.
Ebony and Ivory Reptiles.
Shout out to the sponsors. Appreciate you, Jason. Appreciate you, Matt. So earlier, you mentioned like y'all season are kind of, it's kind of like opposite of ours, right? So can you dive into that a little bit more in depth?
Yeah, so basically we start pairing up in, I start pairing up between May and June.
Okay.
But I actually start, so I do ambient temperature. So I do have hotspots, of course. So I keep my hotspots at 51 degrees Celsius, which is around, I think, 87 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly. And then what I do is I actually manipulate my room temperature. So I drop it from the start of April, I drop it from 28 degrees Celsius to 26 degrees. And then I run that for the duration of April. Then the starting May, I drop it from 26 to 24 degrees. And then I run that until most of my females is ovulated. So like I said, I start to pair May, June, and then I'd say by the end of, I try and stop breeding like end of October. That's when I really try and, you know, stop breeding the females. And then there's the odd occasion where, you know, there's one or two females that's still building follicles that still needs to be paired, you know, because I've got a fairly, how can you say, not larger collection, but we do around 100 clutches a season, you know, depending on, I not chop and change, but some seasons I may do a bit less, or same, so some seasons I do, you know, the same number. But yeah, so it, my season actually stretches a bit further out as well, you know, so I still actually have females that need to lay clutches, you know, and we're actually going onto the new season. So yeah, basically, we start to pair around May, in the May, and then we stop in pairing around October, November, just depending on the season.
Okay. So, I was about to say, how long have you been doing like 100 clutches? Like, how long has that been going on?
No, it's not been too long, man. So, I did in 2017 was, so prior to 2017, I was breeding around maybe between 5 and 15 clutches a season. And in 2017, you know, I had most of my females were up to size. So then I bred 76 clutches that season. And honestly, you know, that back then I wasn't so, how can you say, so fested or so established in the hobby. So, you know, that was honestly probably not the most wise decision, you know, because I think it was maybe, I should have maybe slowly started into it, if you get what I'm saying, maybe bred a bit less clutches. And that's what I saw. So, and the next 2 or 3 years, I only bred, I think, 50 clutches, which were more on par, I think, as the collection grew. And then only in 2021 is where we started to do a bit higher number clutches again. Then we did 78 clutches. And then last year, or the 2022-2023 season, we did 96 clutches. And then this year was the first year we did 100 clutches. We did actually 103 clutches there.
How many? 130 or 103?
No, 103. Sorry.
103. Okay. Okay. So that year or those 2 years where you dropped from, I think you said 15 to like 70 something, like how was that transition? I know for me, jumping from like 10 to like, I think we did 20 this past year, like that was like a huge transition for me. So I can only imagine how jumping from 15 to the 70s, how was that?
It was a, yeah, it's a huge transition, man, you know, in terms of just feeding animals, yeah, looking after the animals, you know, it's just so, it was so mesmerizing, you know, because there's so many awesome stuff, you know. It's firstly, what do you need to keep back? You know, you can't keep back everything. That's the hardest decision. But I must say, in terms of the workload, you know, it's it definitely adds up, eh? You know, so you need, even for myself now coming into this new season, you know, the chances of myself producing 100 clutches again is maybe slim. I'm going to be honest with you, because I already, every season, I don't like to do repetitive pairings. So, you know, once I've produced my desired animal, I don't really do the pairing again. Unless it's something where I really think, you know, there's true potential, or I miss, for instance, I got a male and I needed a female for a project, then I won't necessarily do the project over. But, yeah, going into that, man, you know, like the transition from, you know, like you said, 10 to 20 clutches, or just that small, like, it's a small but a huge jump. You know, it's almost double your production. You know, I think you need to know that the workload is going to be more. You know, you're going to have to put more time in advertising the animals, cleaning the animals, feeding the animals. You know, there's a lot that goes into it. So you need to really strategically plan it. You know, so for even for myself coming up into this new season, I think I might only breed maybe 60 clutches. It depends. It really depends on which animals I really want to pair this season, because, like I said, I don't want to be producing redundant clutches, stuff that I already have got in the collection. So every odd year, I always say, you know, it changes. So my season was completely different this year compared to the previous year. You know, this year I didn't maybe produce as many visually striking animals, but I produced long-term animals for different projects. And this coming year is going to be, again, different, where I maybe focus on producing more of the visual animals and keep back a bit on the double hits and stuff. And so every season I like to change it up, and that also depends on the clutches of the number of clutches then as well. Eh?
Gotcha. So that year where you made like the big jump, were you breeding your own rodents at the time?
Yeah, I did. Nice. But still, you know, it's still to the point now, you know, last year I spent almost, I'd say like $25,000 just on buying rodents in, you know, and that's with myself having already a well-established rat facility or rat colonies. So yeah, I think it's very important in general, if you breed with the animals, to have your own collection of rodents. You know, you can be dependent on, you know, supply of rodents, but I don't know how it's, if you guys are side, I think you've got more established breeders, you know, of rodents and stuff. But with us, there's not really people that's really doing it as a full-time job or really as established breeding facility, you know. So I understand it's hard for them also to keep up with quantities. So I always say, as far as possible, try and breed your own rodents. Then you can assure what your snakes are feeding. You know what your rodents are eating. You know how they looked after, you know. And at the end of the day, that's what's going into your snake, you know. And that's, I really think that's very important. You know, you can't feed rodents which is in a poor condition to your animals and expect your animal to be, you know, thriving, you know. So I think in terms of the rodents, it's very important to breed your own rodents as well. Eh?
Gotcha. So what are some of the most exciting projects that you're looking for this current breeding season?
Yes, man, which one's not? Eh? There's so many, actually. But I'm really excited. I bought a OD Puzzle Double Head Ultramore Hypo from CTH Reptiles. Nice. I think it's Chandler. Yeah. I bought it from him, and a stunning animal. So I'm really excited to incorporate that animal into the Ultramore project, because I've got a few, you know, cool females in that project. So I think really excited to see some puzzle or Ultramore head puzzles and Ultramore puzzle combos coming this season. I'm quite heavily also into the zebra project. fingers crossed that we can see at least a DG Zebra this season. I've got a couple of triple head females, already in the racks and stuff. So hopefully we can see some of those coming up. And I think it's a no-brainer is the Mandarins as well. I think they've got some good potential and some hype around it at the moment. And I think Lace and Mandarin is two of the codoms which I really want to try and push in the collection as well. Just yet again, getting back to the factor of producing those animals, which is going to look stunning as adults. You know, that's where I really want to get to, man.
Nice, nice. In terms of holdbacks, like you mentioned earlier, you can't hold everything back. Like, are you more often than not to hold back a whole bunch of stuff and you have to kind of talk yourself out of it? Or are you pretty disciplined with that?
Yeah, it's a difficult. Yeah, man, it's a very good question, actually.
It's also hard.
Yeah, so it depends. It really depends on the project itself and where I'm at with that project. If it's something I really want to, how can you say, make a baseline in the collection, I'll maybe keep back a bit more animals from that project. But yeah, each season it varies as well. So last year I kept back. So most of my pairings that I make, there's very few pairings that I actually make which is for the market, if you get what I'm saying. So most of the pairings I make is for potential of holdbacks. So I'd say on an average, I try and keep one baby per clutch, you know, as far as possible if there's something I want. So like last year or the 2022-2023 season, I kept back, I think it was 80 animals. Okay. And those were really like very specific animals. There's one or two animals that are that I saw weren't like part of the projects which I sold on, but it was very few selective animals. So I'm very specific in what I'm keeping back as well, you know, and where my baseline of collection yet again is, you know, which is Desert Ghost, Clown and Pipe. So I always try and see incorporate, you know, animals which will work well with those animals in the near future as well.
Gotcha. I realize there may be more than one answer to this, but like just thinking back, like what's that one that you let go that you wish you wouldn't have let go?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. I'd say probably the last animal, which is it was probably haunting me a couple of nights, is the Super OD Leopard Mojave Ultramo Hyper Clown. And she went to South Korea, and you know, that was one of those animals yet again where you say, like, you know, do you need to keep it back? You know, what's the situation? Because I already had, you know, two other females, two other Ultramo Clown females and an Ultramo Hyper Clown female which I kept back. So now it was a point of I'm just keeping back another female for the sake of keeping, you know, if you get what I'm saying. So but that's definitely one of the animals that's will probably one of my biggest regrets, just because it's so stunning, man. Just so stunning, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard, man, because sometimes you want to keep it because it's nice, but at the same time, you're like, I really don't need it, and so you don't want to like just hoard. But sometimes it's hard, though, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's probably the hardest thing about the whole industry, man, is selling the animals. Honestly, you know, it's. That's probably the hardest thing for myself, you know, just because, you know, you can hatch a clutch of Batmans or whatever, you know, and each of them can be, or pints, let's say pints, you know, and each of the babies will look completely different. You know, they're so genetically diverse, and, you know, that's where it really gets hard to, you know, you need to also, like you said, you can't hold and keep back everything. So you need to be also specific in what you're doing. And also think about long-term, how is this specific gene or this specific animal going to add value to my collection for the next 5 years or 2 years or whatever. You know, that's why I said, you know, I try and, especially if I keep back females, I keep back females which I know I use year on end, you know, where I know I can, each year I can take it to a different project. You know, that's why I say, like, double recessive females is a great baseline, in my opinion. I know it's not always as easy accessible, but I think double recessives, just in terms of females, is a really great baseline, because you can get another recessive which is head for that double recessive female, and start getting straight into, you know, triple recessive projects. And each year, either you can do that or you can put a new co-dominant gene stack to that double recessive female and start working with that project again. Where with a male, I just feel a male in general, with all males in general, they become redundant after like 2 years, just because, you know, you either breed something which is better or you can replace that animal. But with a female, I just believe, you know, you can just use a year on end to much different projects as well. Eh?
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. Have you made a Desert Ghost Clown Pot or Desert Ghost Clown Pot combo yet?
Yeah, man, I wished, hey, but I've missed out actually this season. I've got one more clutch for it. It was an OD Yellow Belly Leopard DG Head Clown or Head Cryptic, and she's 50% head for pied. And she was bred to a pied double head DG Clown. So we're holding thumbs, man. It's definitely in the pipelines. That's, of course, one of my dream animals. I mean, my three main recessives into one. So I really hope to hatch it out in the next year, I'd say. That will be really amazing if I'm able to hatch it out. Eh?
Yeah, that'll be super dope. Really dope. Speaking of 50% head, do y'all have genetic testing over there?
No, so, but I did with the last shipment, we did export some of the sheds. So it's just a bit more complicated just because, you know, they basically classified. It's the same process of exporting an animal, you know. So I did some shed testing through Charlie of Grey Rider Reptiles.
Nice.
And yeah, in the future, I definitely think I'll incorporate more genetic shed testing. I think it's a great thing for the industry because it's, you know, it clears up a lot of, you know, it answers a lot of questions as well, you know, and it speeds up the timing. And also, you know, it can save you many years in certain projects. So I think it's a huge addition to the reptile hobby.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of like shipping and whatnot, you work with like some American companies, right, for shipping, because I think seen like Bushville Reptiles or something like that. Like I saw someone who had it listed on the Morph Market, they were going to get a shipment from you. So do you got that arrangement with just like that particular company, or do you got arrangements with a lot of companies?
No, so we've got only currently we work with Nicole and Warren Klein of Bushville Reptiles. And then their importing and exporting company is Reptile Hub International. So we've been working with them since 2021. And so far, so good. So we try and ship every third month, just depending on the orders to the US. So the next one is actually planned to come over the end of March, starting of April, which will go directly to Nicole and Warren. And then once they arrive, you know, because they're in Rhode Island. So once they arrive there in Rhode Island, they will be shipped out, you know, to the different customers. But yeah, currently we just work with Nicole and Warren of Bushveld Reptiles, and then the importing and shipping company is Reptile Hub International.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so that's how that works. Yeah, I saw that, and I had it on my list to ask you about it. So let's talk about wins and losses. What's been some of the most significant wins in your breeding journey so far?
I'd say probably, some of the projects that I've been working with, you know, some of the animals have just, you know, proved out in the sense where, you know, you had high expectations. I'd definitely say one of the projects that really laid out the foundation was the Batman project. You know, that was probably one of my earliest investments that I ever bought. It was a pastel Batman from Justin. And that is by far my biggest win. I mean, in terms of that male, I still have that male, which I bought in 2015. And I mean, in terms of that male, he's outlaid my foundation of my collection. You know, most of the Ultramar clowns, Hyper clowns, all of these projects, and even the clown combos that we produce, you know, originated from that snake. So I'd say in terms of a huge win for our collection was investing into that powerhouse male. You know, back then, I think Batmans were still selling, I think it was $10,000 or $11,000, you know, so it was a huge hefty investment for myself. But I think that male really panned out and outlaid the collection for many years to come, you know, in terms of what he's added in collection-wise and value, and also breeding potential.
Nice. Yeah, man, Batman's was an early combo that I saw. I mean, it was many years after that. Like I said, we got in like 4 years ago, and Batman's was like one of the first things that I saw that I liked in terms of like clown combos and whatnot. So yeah, that's definitely a good morph combo to work with. And I think it's still a lot of stuff to do like in double recessive projects with the Batmans, because I still haven't seen like a lot of like double or triple recessive
Batman
combos. So it's still a good bit to do, like even with that base.
Yeah, that's the awesome thing is, man, you know, like we've seen now, you know, the clown combinations, you know, now we're going to the next step. We're going to the DG clown versions and the hyper clowns and the ultramore clowns. But we still have, you know, to go to the quads and the triples and all of these things. And we don't even know how the codoms, we've got an idea how they're going to react in these combinations, but we don't know how it's going to look exactly. So that's the exciting thing is, man, you know, every year we're just pushing it further and further. And I think with the true potential, I think we're still just scratching the surface. I think the best is still yet to come. I honestly still believe it, you know. And like you said, we haven't seen these leopard spot nose and Batman combos in double recessives and triple recessive animals. And I think that's, you know, applicable with most of the co-dominant mutations that we've seen in other single recessives. We haven't seen them in taken to, you know, double recessive and triple recessive animals.
Facts. And I think at the end of the day, like that's what pushes the market. And like what I mean by that, like I know like where we're at right now and is a market correction, things are a little bit slower and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, it's like that passion for like creating those dope combos and like pushing the genetics forward and just pushing the industry forward from an artistic standpoint and just like making really cool stuff. Like that's what keeps the industry going.
Yeah, you know what, man? I think everyone, you know, I think we had a couple of great years with the snakes and the ball pythons and stuff. So I think, you know, I definitely agree with you. I think there was, I think everyone could have seen it as a big market correction or whatever. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing as well. You know, I think it's, I think everyone can, how can you say, build their collection in a sense where they really want to head into, you know, which you couldn't maybe do a couple of years prior because some stuff could have been unattainable or too expensive. But now I think as well, you can really outlay the foundation of your collection. And if you want to get into a project that you haven't got in the past, you know, it's the time now because you can really, you know, take your collection to the next step. And I believe, you know, in my honest opinion, we've had much worse years in the snakes, in the ball pythons in general. Okay, so I must say, yeah, there has been some significant price decreases, and you know, but unfortunately, I think that's applicable with any industry. You know, it's not just with the snakes, and I don't think we can really just pinpoint the snakes of being the factor of it. You know, so I think now the best is just to wait it out, work, and like you said, work on the projects which you want to work with. Try and produce animals which is visually stunning and which you are, you know, passionate about, and the rest will follow, man. That's what I've always believed. You know, I believe as well, if you look after the animals, they look after you, you know. So just make sure your main priority is, you know, keeping and maintaining the health of the animal. That's the biggest thing.
Absolutely. And so I started off that with wins and losses, but I didn't circle back to the losses question. So flip side of the wins question, like what's been like some of the biggest like L's you took, and how did you bounce back, and what did you learn from that?
So I'd say that one of the biggest L's I ever, starting off was trusting people, if you get what I'm saying, especially when I was much younger. You know, I was looking, you know, at some people as a mentor, you know, and I think at the end of the day is, you know, I think if you start, you know, be very certain with the people that you also, how can you say, mingle with or with who you're to be dealing with, you know, make sure that they've got the same visions and stuff in mind with you. But you're early on, you know, I did get, I would say not burnt, but, you know, I trusted someone with, you know, some of my animals early on, and it didn't go as planned. You know, I lost a lot of my original snakes. Like I invested very early on into Banana and Champagne. And, you know, I never got actually to see one of those animals because, you know, the breeder that I was working with back then actually took advantage of the project, and I never seen a baby from that. So I just think, you know, that was probably, honestly, one of the most demotivating things, you know, in terms of starting off. But, you know, over the years, it's also, you know, it's a learning curve, man. You know, I say with everything, you know, it's a learning curve, and now you just need to be more on top of it. You know, you can't just, how can you say, give your animal, well, not give your animals, but you need to be very specific on who you trust and who you also involve into the circle. So I just think, you know, just be very, very cautious, you know, especially with breeding collabs and all of those things. Make sure you've got a set agreement with the other person beforehand, because, you know, otherwise it can make some confusion, or, you know, it could be an end of a relationship, you know, whether it's being a friendly relationship or business relationship. But you're just trying to make sure that everything is cleared up beforehand.
So going back, you said that the person took advantage, or what did you say? So what exactly did they do? You don't have to say like their names or anything like that, but what exactly did they do? Did they breed the animal and like keep the hatchlings? Like what exactly happened?
Yeah, you know, I think back then it was, I think 20 odd animals. I mean, this is probably what, 8 years ago, man. You know, so it's been quite some time. But I had a group of, I think it was 20 animals, which were quite, you know, highly sought after animals back then. And, you know, in the 2 or 3 years which they were at his place, you know, I never saw one baby actually from the animals come, you know. And unfortunately, some of the animals also perished with him, you know. So it was probably also, how can you say, my fault, because I didn't stay, not I'd say didn't stay on top of it, but I should have actually reached out more and, you know, actually went. The only thing is that he was quite far away from us, you know. So it's not just driving around a corner and go checking up on your snakes, you know. You had to go once a year and then you check the animals, and you know, it's easy to actually not get any hatchlings from it, you know. So it was just basically I took my animals there and I never got actually out of it. And the animals actually, you know, some of the animals I didn't even get back, you know, which were especially starting out with the banana and stuff, with those things, you know, those were huge investments for me back then, you know. And I was really also counting on working those genes into the collection. So I think it was just more of, you know, not getting the desired animals, or just getting, you know, the animals back.
Gotcha. Okay. So moving on from that topic, I do want to talk about like social media stuff. I know like one of the first places that I came across you was like your YouTube channel. I think that was the first place I saw you. Then obviously followed you on IG and stuff like that. So talk about like your social media strategy and how you approach social media.
Yeah, so, you know, with Instagram and stuff like that, so we, for long, I was, like you say, a couple of years, I was, like, inconsistent on YouTube, you know. I would have posted a video once or twice, let's say, in a month, and then I'll be, like, you know, off YouTube for another 6 months, you know. So I wasn't really consistent, and at the start of 2022, that's where we started to, I actually got one of my friends to help me with the videos and stuff. So he started to help me film and edit and all of those things. And in terms of the YouTube and stuff, I really think it's a great platform to showcase your animals and to showcase what you are doing and which projects you're working with. So we try and, you know, try and post once a week a video now on YouTube, trying to do a bit of like educational videos as well sometimes, and, you know, just showing the projects that we're doing in the collection. But in terms of, you know, a strategy on, you know, Instagram and Facebook and those things, I don't really have like a certain like strategy, if you get what I'm saying. I just try and, you know, stay constant and try and regularly, you know, update what's going on in the facility, you know, and also when we, you know, post new snakes on Morph Market or whatever, just to update that we've got, you know, new animals on the site. But yeah, in terms of that, I think the most important thing is consistency, and also reaching out to, you know, like-minded people, you know, to build your connection and establish a community of trust. You know, I always say there's no harm in reaching out to people just speaking about the snakes, you know, and see where they're at, and you always get some valuable information about that. So I think the most important is just staying constant, networking, and yeah, just be on top of it, man. That's the most important thing, eh?
Yeah, it's definitely super important to build relationships and get you like that group of folks that you can like really talk to, who really got your best interest in mind and who you can trust. It's definitely important to build that network. At the end of the day, I mean, I know it sounds cliche, but your network is your net worth. But like, yeah, it's important to get good people in your corner and get good people on your side.
No, I agree with you. You know, so with Instagram and those things, I always say, you know, social media can be a terrible thing, you know, so just be, like you say, like careful and sometimes what you post and stuff. But I think it's also a great platform, you know, because it really helps also people to retrieve information. You know, that's how I got also most of my early on, some of my most valuable information was by watching YouTube, listening to podcasts, and, you know, just checking what everyone else is doing and interacting with the guys. Eh?
Gotcha. Gotcha. And so you're doing this like full time still, right?
Yeah, so I actually only finished studying this past year. So I was still studying here at a local university.
What did you pick up?
Hey, sorry?
What did you take up at school? Like, what was your major?
So I did a major in business management.
Nice.
Yeah. So currently, yeah, it's my I do it full time currently. But you know, I've got here and there, I've got a few other projects that I'm also working on still.
Gotcha. Do you ever get burnout any? And if so, what do you do to combat that?
Yeah, I think, you know, towards the end of the year, it gets quite, you know, hectic, especially with the YouTube, you know, trying to maintain, you know, doing once a week a video, you know, it gets quite tough. I think even for yourself, you know, you understand there's a lot of production and a lot of time that goes into it. So I think there is definitely some time where you need to really, you know, just lay a bit back and maybe just focus a bit on the animals and just calm down a bit. But yeah, in terms of my easiest way is to, you know, to, how can you say, like you said, if you're going to get burned out or something like that, it's just to retrieve a bit, you know, maybe go try and schedule, do the YouTube videos and stuff beforehand, try and get them filmed beforehand for a month or two in advance. And then just focus on the animals, man. You know, just getting back to the animals and working with the snakes. That's where I still get the most of my peace, honestly. You know, just checking and working with the animals. And, you know, I really believe, you know, some people say that the animals aren't so, or the snakes are not so smart or so inquisitive. But, you know, they're actually amazing animals and all of them differ, you know. So just to read and really go in depth and work with the animals is where I really get a lot of pleasure as well, man.
Facts. Yeah. I use a similar strategy. Like to your point, it can be like a lot of grind, a lot of ripping and running. So sometimes you can get burnt out with it. You know what I mean? And so like a lot of times, like I'll just kind of like chill and I won't be on social media that much. I won't check like a whole bunch of messages for a while. Like I just kind of like chill. I'll handle stuff like around the facility, like chill with the fam or whatever. But yeah, I just kind of like take down my activity in like some of the other spaces, but at the same time you still got to like work with the snakes and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, like that's calming, because like being in the snake room, just looking, seeing your snakes grow, thinking about like future plans and stuff like that, and like, so that's pretty cool. Like it's just really kind of a getaway.
Yeah, you know what, and I would say, man, is, you know, like another thing is that I've quite enjoyed over the course, you know, the last couple of months, is I built outside enclosures for, you know, my iguanas and my bearded dragons and those things. And just working with those species as well, which is a bit different to the ball pythons, you know, it also brings a lot of joy, you know. And in the afternoons after everything, I go out and I'd feed the caiman lizards and feed the iguanas and, you know, just spray down the cages and stuff. And that also brings a lot of, like, calmness, you know, just working with an animal in a different environment as well, you know. So I would say is, you know, if you're in the ball pythons and stuff, you know, and you want to do something as well, just a bit different, like a different animal or whatever, you know, get something which is completely different, you know, a reptile as well, but something that you can also interact with at a different level, if you get what I'm saying, because that also sometimes takes a bit of the stress away, and, you know, just working with the animals at the end of the day.
Carpet pythons are like my favorite snake. Like, don't tell my ball pythons, but carpet pythons. And we got three different species of carpet pythons, but just like carpet pythons in general, like those are my favorite snakes.
Yeah, they're awesome, man. Yeah, I used to have a carpet bath, and I think it was just a normal, I can't remember exactly, but it wasn't just a normal carpet bath. Can't remember which
species. Was it a jungle carpet?
Yeah, it was a jungle, right? It was actually a jungle carpet, yeah. And another species which is similar is the chondros. You know, I think everyone likes the chondros. I think there's nothing, I mean, they're awesome animals, man. You know, I used to have a couple of them as well. I still have two of them. I actually got them recently. And the chondros are also amazing animal to work with. You know, they're so different. And, you know, just compared to the bull pythons and stuff, they, you know, different species, how you keep them and all of those things. And I think it's also just a stunning animal to work with, eh?
Yeah, and it's a totally different process. I know at least for us, it was a totally different process. Like, we're just socializing the carpet pythons. There's different challenges you got to work through. I remember, like, we got a highlighter line jungle carpet python, and I had him in, like, this little small, like, probably like a 15 quart, and I thought everything was going to be fine, but it was a little crack at the top. Got right through it. And I thought it was going to be fine because I was like, in my mind, I keep all my ball python hatches and this is fine. But like, he shimmied right on through it.
Yeah, you could. It's like, actually, I mean, it's quite cool to see. Like, I mean, carpet python is quite a, it's not a small species, you know, it's a quite a large species of snakes, but I mean, they hatch out tiny, man, you know. So it's quite cool to see, you know, that such a small snake can end up being so big. You know, if you compare it to a ball python, they hatch out much larger. But they're so different. And the carpet pythons, I know, are a bit more nippy sometimes. I don't know how's your experience with them, but they're definitely a bit more, like, not on the edge, but they a bit more, yeah, definitely more on the nippier side, eh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially when they're smaller. Like, I got three jungle carpet pythons, and all of them were nippy when they were smaller. They've all, for the most part, calmed down. Two, definitely. One, he's been doing good. Like, he's been on a stretch of some months and he's been just fine. Yeah. But I've been on a stretch of months before and he reverted and backtracked.
Okay. Yeah.
But he's been on like a pretty long stretch now and he's getting bigger now too. So he might be good to go. We'll see. And then we got Gruttles and we got a Coastal. Both of those are fine, like, as hash. Okay. I never had any issues with them.
They're really?
Okay. Yeah.
I must say the Gruttles are quite cool. The other species, I don't think it's necessarily a carpet python species, but I think it's in the same, like, family. It's the diamond, I think it's a diamondback or diamond pythons. I can't
remember. Yeah, that's Morelia too. Yeah.
Yeah, those are also amazing, man. I must say those. And I don't think we've got any of those in South Africa. Maybe many years we used to have them, but unfortunately, carpet pythons has also been classified as an alien invasive species in some of the states. So which has really halted how can you say, you know, the keeping of them, eh?
Gotcha. Yeah, diamonds, I think it's a special way you have to keep them, where you have to, like, cool them down for part of the year. And so I like them. Like, I think they're, like, super dope and visually stunning, but I was hesitant to, like, even try to get one because I didn't want to, like, have it, like, die in my care, because
I
didn't feel experienced enough to be dealing with that at the time. And then right now, like, I'm trying to limit, like, bringing more snakes in than what I need to. And
yeah, so,
I'm just kind of chilling. But diamonds, real nice.
Yeah, no, they're awesome, man. I must say, you know, even just the, how can you say, the Morelia species, there's some awesome animals in that project, or in that species of animals, you know. So, and it's a bit more of a, like, how can you say, a trickier species to keep on. I think, you know, if your setup is dialed in, you know, I don't think necessarily you should have problems, but yeah, they're definitely a bit different keeping, you know, compared to the bull pythons and stuff, eh?
And my Coastal girl, she's getting big. Like, she's got to be at least 6 feet. Like, she's getting big. Like, she's not super big around, but, like, because, I mean, they don't naturally get big around like ball pythons, but she's just long.
Yeah, and I like the head structure of the carpet pythons and stuff. They've got like a very bulky head almost, you know, which is very cool. I must say, a dream animal of mine is the Boulens pythons. You know, those are, you know,
nice.
Yeah, those are on the radar as well. Yeah, awesome animals. I must say those are also probably a dream species of mine, which I'll probably try and get in sometime, you know, when the timing is right as well, of course.
So your chondros, are they old enough to be sexed yet, or are they still younger?
They're going on to 18 months almost, you know, so I'll probably wait. No rush, man, you know, so probably in the next, like, let's say a year or so, I'll probably get them sexed or so. Or just try and check also the sheds, you know, if I start seeing, like, plugs or something like that, you know, then it could be an indication of a male or something like that.
Would you ever breed? If you had, let's say you had a 1.1, would you consider breeding?
Yeah, so I have bred chondros in the past.
Oh, wow. Okay, nice.
Yeah, I bred actually. So I've bred in a span of, I think it was 3 years, so 3 seasons I bred with them. I bred 4 clutches. And yeah, definitely in the works again, man. You know, it's not something I'm banking on, or, you know, which is, if it happens, it happens again. But if it doesn't happen, you know, I'm not too bothered about it. But yeah, definitely in the near future, I'd like to try with the chondros again. I just feel, you know, back then, you know, I had awesome chondros. Most of them were actually, you know, designer chondros from the States, which we imported. But I think, you know, maybe I had too much different species back then, because I had the ball pythons, the hognose, and the GTPs, which I was trying to work with everything, you know, and maybe it was too many, you know, if you get what I'm saying, to try and do all three in the same time. So now, you know, then I actually sold the GTPs, and then when we moved to this facility, I also made the hognose a lot less, you know, so we focused now mostly on the ball pythons now, and that's where I really seen also a huge change in my collection in terms of the ball pythons. But I think, you know, now I've got a better, how can you say, understanding as well. And I think next time, if we get to the situation where we start breeding the chondros, hopefully, you know, I've got a bit more experience, especially in raising the babies, you know, because that was something I struggled immensely with, you know, in terms of the breeding. Honestly, the chondros were, in my opinion, not as hard to breed. I didn't really struggle to get the females to breed and lay eggs, but to get the hatchlings feeding was a totally different mission, totally different mission.
So what tricks or whatnot did you have to do? Like, I heard, and I don't know a whole lot about, like, getting chondro hatchlings on food, but, like, I've heard people talk about, like, just really, like, having to sit there with, like, each one individually and, like, wiggle the rotor in the face and just kind of get it pissed off till it finally, like, takes it. Is that what you had to do, or did you do something different?
Yeah, man, I tried everything, you know. I think I was able to breed around, I think it was 40-odd or 50-odd GTPs, hatchling neonates. And by myself, I was able to get around 20 to 30 established. And unfortunately, the rest, you know, it was a real struggle. I'm going to be honest with you. And what I, you know, what I did back then, I was trying everything. You know, I was trying to feed pinkies at night. I was trying to actually, you know, brain the pinkies, trying to scent them with either, you know, chick feathers, or actually putting chick feathers on. And, you know, some of it was a hit and miss. You know, some of them were taking it quite easily. And some of them, you know, they would literally grab the mice item or the prey item, and literally start coiling and just leave it at any time, you know, and then stop eating, you know. So, but now I know like MJ is doing quite well with them as well, and there's a lot of people doing well with the GTPs. And I think it's the same as, you know, as that is also building a community and stuff more, you know, it's I think people are starting to share also more openly on how to get the hatchings and stuff established. So I'm going to be honest with you, I can't tell you exactly, you know, how to get them established. I don't want to give the wrong information and stuff out now. But I think, you know, there's definitely some tips and tricks that I've seen, you know, people incorporate that I never even thought about it. You know, I know one of the local breeders down here who's also well established with the chondros and stuff. He actually tube fed some of the hatchlings. He tube fed some of them just to get them started as well, with some. It's actually like a liquid cat food almost, you know, so that's also quite interesting. Yeah, but like I said, I don't want to also give the wrong information out, but I must say that's also a thing that I never thought about, you know, and it actually seems to work.
Nice. Yeah, when we first started and start building collection, I know me, I started like snowballing with stuff and like picking up different species. And the plan at the time was to like breed different species. But then once I started learning more, I started like slowing down and started thinking about it differently. It's like, let me pump the brakes a little bit. As far as breeding go, I'm just focused on ball pythons for now. Yeah. I'll keep the species that I got, but I'm not like in any kind of rush to breed or anything like that. Just enjoying the keeping component of it for now. Some of my boas, I might sell some of the boas because I really want to focus more so on the pythons. Definitely not trying to breed other species right now. I really just want to focus on the ball pythons, get going with that, and then maybe in the future, maybe add something on and make it more of an iterative kind of growth process, as opposed to like diving like head first into breeding a whole bunch of different species.
I think it's very difficult to just maintain different species in general, man. You know, just to control. I think ambient temperature plays a huge role in keeping the animals in general, and I don't think people emphasize it enough. You know, I think the ambient temperature plays a significant role in just in terms of the health and of the animal, and also the breeding of the animal. You know, so if you've got, you know, plenty of different species, you know, it's going to be very hard to maintain the perfect conditions for each and every one. You know, you can set up the enclosures as far as possible, but you know, it's still going to be very hard to mimic and get exactly what you want if you keep, you know, 20 odd species or whatever, right?
Exactly. 100%. So, bro, I can't believe it's been an hour and a half already, man. Time has flown by.
Yeah, I know it has, man. It has. But, yeah, I know it's been an awesome show. Thanks again for having me on, Mike. I really appreciate it, man.
Yes, sir. Before I let you get out of here and enjoy the rest of the night, is there anything you want to let the listeners know about, stuff to be on the lookout for, all that stuff? Definitely pump your social media and all that good stuff.
Yeah, so we, like I said, we post once a week on YouTube every Friday. I'm not exactly sure which timing it is on your guys' side, but it's probably in the morning hours, you know, of most of your time regions. Some awesome combos, there's in the Ultramore Clown stuff, and, you know, some new projects that we'll be showcasing on the YouTube videos. And check out the Morph Market pages. We are shipping to the US in the next 6 weeks at the most. So if there's something you see on Morph Market or whatever, just let us know and we can try and work something out. And I hope to see you guys in Tinley this year, later this year, not this coming one in March. I'll definitely see you guys in Chicago in October.
Nice. Yeah, that'd be dope. Hopefully we can make it to Tinley in October too. We got it planned right now, so hopefully everything works out with that. Definitely looking forward to that. I haven't been to Tinley since October 2022. That's the only time I've been to Tinley. Had a chance to get back since.
I was once in Tinley in 2017, man. And it was
okay.
Yeah, and it was actually crazy just to see how, you know, how huge it is compared to us. You know, I think, and Reptile Expo is probably maybe a 20th of what your guys' Tinley Park is at the most. You know, it is just crazy to see hours and hours on of, you know, different animals, you know, and different species. So yeah, it's definitely, I'm looking very forward to going to Tinley this year, man.
Yeah, Tinley was crazy that year I went. Man, it was like barely like standing room. Like,
yeah, it's crazy. Like
6 inches from you every which way you turn. So yeah, it was cool. I had a lot of fun at Tinley. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I know, it's awesome, man. But yo, Mike, you need to come down to South Africa, man. You need to come check out.
That'll be dope.
You know, it will be awesome to have you guys as well. You know, to come check out some expos here, or come attend an expo here, and we can just go around and, you know, look at some awesome animals local to South Africa and stuff, eh?
That'll be dope. Hit the safari, that'll be dope.
Yeah, man. We can go check the Big Five and all that. Those are awesome, eh?
Yeah, that'll be a dope trip. Like, real talk. So I appreciate it, bro. Definitely, man, let's stay in touch, and definitely hope I get to see you in Tinley in October. Appreciate you coming on the show tonight. Definitely appreciate all the listeners for coming, checking us out. each and every Thursday. This episode will get uploaded to the audio only podcast platform soon after the show. Definitely make sure you're following Reptiles for Centuries everywhere that you can follow them. Again, man, appreciate you coming out and appreciate the chat for Clutch Conversations. I'm Mike, the lovely lady behind the scenes is Takara. Thank y'all for coming out. Be blessed. Peace.